All right, guys. My name is Anthony Bandiero, attorney and senior legal instructor for Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training, bringing another search and seizure show with my good friend, Chris McFarland. How are you doing, my friend Chris?
Good. Glad to be here.
All right. So look, the rules of engagement is, let's get down to business. We just finished a search and seizure webinar, and we have some people here that may have some questions. Who has a question? This is the rules of engagement. All you do is need a microphone. You do not need a camera. We can't use your camera. The only people you can see is you and me. It's Chris and I. Chris and me, right? So just, we'll ask you if you have a question. We'll ask you to turn on your mic. You turn on your mic, then everybody can hear you and so forth. All right. So that's what we want. We want you guys to ask questions. Now, if you have a question, just put in the chat. Me, I got a question. Okay. So Amanda, let me give you the number. Hold on. All right. I'm sending you to my number right now, Amanda. All right, go for it. And so, Rick, is it still having an issue, right? All right. Hey, Amanda.
How's it going?
Good, good, good. All right, what you got?
So I was reading a case, U.S. versus Knapp out of the 10th Circuit.
Yeah.
And that's... it was...
is that the search?
Gantt searches.
Yeah, this the Gantt search for bags, right?
Right.
Okay, go on.
So if we don't have the reason to believe there's evidence of a crime going to be found within that bag, we can't search it, correct?
Well, hold on. But I think Knapp is about the fact that it wasn't in their immediate control, wasn't it? Wasn't that an immediate control issue?
Yes.
So, but let's back up. So if you are going to arrest somebody, right? And you don't have any reason to believe that there's evidence in that bag. Let's just, you know, but aren't you going to take the bag anyway to the jail? They're not going to leave your property on the sidewalk, right?
Yes. And in this case, it was, she had offered to leave her bag inside the truck and they said no.
Yep.
Ask for consent. No. And then they searched it anyway.
Correct. So Chris, what do you hear the scenario, Chris, about what's kind of going on there?
Yeah, I did.
What's your feedback on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's like Anthony's referring to there, you know, you're going to take the bag anyway for safekeeping, so just leaving it there.
But she wants to leave with her friends though, right? Amanda?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So Chris, make sure you know, if that's part of the analysis, she has friends willing and able for to take the bag.
Yeah, I think that changes things in the circumstance then, because it's going to be hard for you to articulate why you need to do that. And you don't want to put yourself in a situation where it's going to be seen as a pretext. And that's why you're doing anything that you may be doing, because I don't remember the case on point, but we have a case where that was exactly what the court referenced, is that was basically a pretext search. And I know in inventories, when we start trying to say, you know, inventories is what we want or why we're doing what we're doing, the courts are very, you know, they're going to review that. They're going to look at that when we would just throw the word inventory out there to make sure that we're not doing things pretextually.
Yeah, they want good faith, right, Chris? Good faith. They want sincere, you know, good faith. They want, like, you know, be on the up and up. They don't want to be some kind of ruse or subterfuge for finding evidence. And right. And my thing is, when I teach this, I'm like, you know, whenever the government searches something, they have to have an interest, right? Why are they doing it? And that person, you know, Knapp or whoever it's going to be, has a privacy interest in her bag. And when the government says, you know what, I'm not going to allow you to leave your purse, backpack, computer with your friends, I'm going to take it and we're going to take it to jail with you because that's what I want. Like, where's the government interest in that, right? Why wouldn't you allow a person to leave their property with who they trust more? Do they trust their sister, brother, wife, husband more than the corrections officers at the jail to take care of their stuff, right? And so the thing is, like, I just don't see the government interest in why they're forcing and why cops are forcing people to take property with them. And by the way, that's the issue here with this Gantt issue. It's only going to come up. It's only going to come up when the person has somebody usually on scene, willing and able to take their property, and now the cops are like, well, damn, what am I going to do here? Am I going to force this person to take it, or can I just let it go, right?
Because let's point this out to everybody that's listening. You know, When we talk about inventories, the whole reason that we inventory is to reduce liability on ourselves. That's one of the big premises behind an inventory. So for you to tell you, well, I've got an inventory because I don't want to be liable, and the courts are going to say, well, you wouldn't have been liable at all had the friends taken it, then it's kind of
a waiver. Right. It's a waiver. They waived it. Yeah. I mean, just show that. Here you go, Your Honor. Here's the, because hopefully there's video on this. Here, this is her saying that she doesn't want her bag taken to jail. Why are we being accused of stealing her Rolex watch now, Your Honor? Amanda, you got a follow up?
Yes. So if we did have a reason to believe there's going to be evidence of a crime found within the bag, the purse that was with the person at the time of the arrest, mm-hmm. would we be able to search it, or would the, I think it's Chadwick, come into play, and would we need a warrant?
No, well, if you had, look, if you're saying you can get a warrant, that means you don't have a reason to believe, you actually have probable cause, right? And right. if you have probable cause, then, you know, that's that now, you know, that's a whole different ball game, right? I mean, you know, you're not going to let property go with when you have probable cause. But let's
look. Would you be able to search it before the warrant, or can you search it just on the incident to arrest?
Well, I can tell you what most cops are doing. They're searching it. They're not getting warrants for bags, you know?
Absolutely.
And you know, and the courts will slice this, you know, push comes to shove, you know, how do we get into that bag, right? What's the recognized exception? Well, you know, a lot of courts will just call it search incident to arrest, right? Those courts that don't require that the bag be in the immediate control at the time of the search, right? But circuits like the Fourth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit and kind of like the Ninth Circuit, especially like in Nevada, they're saying once that, maybe some other circuits, but once, and once some other states like Wyoming, once that bag is out of their immediate control, it's game over. You don't have a search incident to arrest exception anymore, right? But, you know, I think courts are going to say inevitable discovery, because no matter what, you're not going to let the bag go, and you're going to have to do an inventory on the bag regardless. So I just don't, I've not seen yet, and maybe Chris can correct me if I'm wrong, but I have not seen a case where the cops had the probable cause and it was out of the control. So they had that immediate control problem, but the courts still suppressed it even with probable cause. Like the courts usually find a way somehow to not lose that evidence, but maybe I'm wrong. Chris, what do you think?
No, I don't think there's a case on point that's going to go that direction with it. I mean, everything you're saying there is accurate as far as the way the courts are reading into that, because the courts are always going to say, well, you know, at the end of the day, this could have been an inevitable discovery anyway, because like we're saying, if we're taking possession of that property, then we've got to inventory that, and we're going to find it there anyway.
Yeah. Either way, you're like, regardless, the evidence is going to be found, right? You're not letting the bag go with the sister. So, but I have said to cops, look, if you have a situation where, you know, it's a very important case, you know, you can't get into that bag under search incident to arrest, you have the PC, you don't have any agency, which, you may have agency, like a gun, right? I, generally speaking, I think the courts are going to, they don't really, you know, a gun in a bag while you're manhandling it to the courthouse, that thing can go off, a loose trigger or something lodges in a trigger and you know, it blows off through the bag. But if you don't have something like that, some kind of agency, I would just say, you know, probably get a warrant if it's for a bigger case. But I'm telling you, courts bend over backwards on this issue, because it is kind of confusing for the officer. Generally speaking, we do not see officers getting warrants for bags when the person's unlawfully arrested and there's evidence, there's PC for the bag.
Okay, just making sure. I just was, that after I read that Knapp case, it kind of threw me off a little bit.
It should throw you off. Sure. It should throw you off, because it's confusing. But remember, they didn't have PC for the bag.
Right.
Yep.
All right, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye. All right, good stuff. Anybody else have a question? And while we're waiting for somebody, let's we have a question that came in from an officer in Kern County, California, Chris. And so basically what happened here is we have a hot pursuit case where yep. The cops are, they're in a helicopter, they're following this guy in a vehicle pursuit, a felony, right? Felony in California on this deal. The guy runs into an illegal gaming casino. So I don't know what that means. He didn't say whether it's a house or it's a business that's actually has that like back room deal, you know, like they see in the movies. But regardless, they wait for the cavalry. They enter, you know, about within 5 to 10 minutes to go. Okay, Emmanuel, hold on. And so that's good. You're on deck. And then they enter the illegal gaming casino. So let's assume that it's like a business, right? Or a house. I don't think the answer changes, but they have the agency. They have, you know, it's fresh pursuit. It's, or I'm sorry, it's actually hot pursuit because it's, they're tracking with the helicopter, right? They get in there and it seems like the guy fled into a, an attic. That's where the evidence is pointing him, because what the witnesses are saying, he went to that back bedroom, and the back bedroom has access to this attic, but they're not going to just stick their head up there because of officer safety. So the fire department shows up and they use their thermal imager, and they see a body, you know, a body in the attic. And of course, that's going to be our suspect. The question for us is, was the use of that thermal imager lawful?
Yeah. And, you know, we look at the what the courts have historically said on using thermal imaging is that we can't do that absent a search warrant.
But you're saying it's not lawful in this case?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, generally speaking.
Oh, generally speaking.
That's what the courts have said when it comes to using thermal imaging devices. But I think if we follow our guidelines on hot pursuit and what we've got, I think that falls well within, you know, our elements, so to speak, here of what we've got for hot pursuit in this matter. I did have a little bit of a question on, you know, what type of facility really this was that we were talking about based on the facts that we were given. Like I said, I don't think that changes the answer there any.
Well, it would only change the answer. Look, I think it changed the answer in some senses. Like, so, you know, with the case that Chris is referring to is it Kylo?
Yes.
Yeah, Kylo. Yeah. 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 So 2001, I think, but that's when the cop used a thermal imager on a garage and detected abnormal heat. And that was used to kind of prove in a search warrant that the guy had a grow lab. Now the Supreme Court said that was essentially private information, right? You're seeing something that's not in plain view. But Chris, you know that the helicopter, right, is using thermal imaging every night in America, right?
Absolutely.
And they use it during hot pursuit. When they're chasing people.
Yeah. And this is different from that because it is a hot pursuit situation.
Exactly. There's agency. But also I would doubt that this guy had any standing to contest it anyway, right?
Sounds like it based on the description.
That's right. If it's this illegal gambling operation, it's probably not his home. He cannot contest the police department holding that thermal imager below the attic. He can't contest their presence.
Absolutely.
And he can't contest them using a thermal imager because he has no expectation of privacy there. Even if it's a friend's house. So anyway, so we're good on two counts.
These situations where in class, you know, I remind officers here, try to get into the habit of developing some type of pattern when you're doing these analysis on situations, and try not to put, you know, the wrong question for a different one and make your job harder in a sense, because really we're looking at this person have standing here and so we don't even need to go to the level of, you know, was this violating anybody's rights or his rights in particular?
Yep. All right. I want to ask one more question before we get to Emmanuel, and Matthew called it out too. He said, no standing. All right. The question comes from in Wisconsin. So is it legal in non-compact states? That might, you know, I know what a compact is. It's like an agreement between states, but I'm not sure why that matters. But to demand an out-of-state driver to follow you to your police station to pay the citation you issued for a citable offense, right? So this would be for a general citation. You're not booking them in the jail. You're just, hey, follow me to my police department and we take credit cards, you know? And I got to tell you, Chris, when I read this, I mean, this is classic 1970s policing, right? It happened all the time, right? It happened all the time. You know, just follow me to the police department to pay your fine. I don't know about this compact business. Who knows? You know, I'm just, from a Fourth Amendment perspective, what is your answer?
Yeah, I mean, I've got an issue with there from a Fourth Amendment standpoint. You know, I mean, I don't think we're on good ground there. I know in South Carolina, we used to do roadside bonds where we would do the very same thing with that. But yeah, that doesn't go on anymore for a lot of different reasons. But I think there's a Fourth Amendment issue there with that.
Are you saying that this is a de facto arrest?
Yes.
Yeah. Boss Hog. You know, I would say that this was prevalent in the old days. And I think they would just call it an arrest. Now, first of all, a lot of things were arrestable in the old days. You know, you could arrest people for speeding. So even if under the Fourth Amendment, even if you got sued, right, I would just say, okay, fine. It's an arrest. We could have taken him to jail, Your Honor. So we actually did one thing lesser. We just took him to our police station and shook him upside down for his coins in his pocket. Right. So, but today I think the question is this: in Wisconsin, can a person get arrested, right, can get arrested for this violation under these facts, under the, you know, the person provides adequate identification and it's not a violation that's going to replicate itself. He's not like part of Cannonball Run. He's like, I'm just let you know, when you write me the citation, I'm going to hit the gas and do another 100. It's not one of those situations. In other words, it's just like me and you, we get stopped in Wisconsin, we get our ticket. Hopefully they know us, Chris, by the way, and they give us a little, you know, professional love.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, but regardless, we get our ticket. They're not arresting us. And so this is a quasi arrest. And this would not be this under the Fourth Amendment. It could be, you know, look, actually back up under the Fourth Amendment. Okay. Under civil liability, right? Under civil liability. Do they pay money on this? I don't think so because of Atwater.
Yeah. I mean, here's my question at the end of the day for this. If you pull me over in Wisconsin and I'm not a Wisconsin resident, you know, I mean, essentially, are you saying, okay, pay your ticket right now or, you know, you're going to jail?
Exactly. That's my question. And I don't think that's not the
that's
answer.
Very
right?
Problematic. No, that's not.
That's not what's happening in Wisconsin in 2024. Maybe no. It happened in 1976 because back in those days, once you lost your violator, you'll never see them again. And there was not the same computer systems and ability to affect their license. Right now, if I don't pay my Wisconsin ticket, can my license in Washington get suspended? Maybe, right? Maybe or a warrant. I'm just throwing it out there. Maybe, I don't know. But the issue is that this is not 1976. You're basically arresting this guy. It probably is not a good arrest. It's not a valid arrest under state law, which means that, you know, that's a problem, right? And then, you know, but under the Fourth Amendment, if I went to sue you, I just don't know if I can get money from you because Atwater says that PC for any violation, even if it's just like no jail time, no, you know, I mean, Atwater was about a CEPA violation in Texas. I just don't know. I don't think we get money. I just don't. So it's a problematic arrest. It's just not going to get, you know, so we may have a search incident to arrest issue. We may have, maybe it turns into an excessive force issue, you know, a use of force, but money, I don't know. It's not good practice, but I don't think you get money. So do you have anything else to add on that, Chris?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Maybe you should get money though. I tell you, you know, some guy told me like, hey, you got to follow me to the police station and pay your $150. I mean, that'd bother me a little bit, but
yeah. Cause now, I mean, now, okay. So now I want to contest the ticket, you know,
right
now what are my options?
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. Emmanuel, let's put you on deck here.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad.
So we have, another just day. So you know, we have a Maryland book out for search and seizure. Our search and seizure book is out. And it's beautiful. The cover is absolutely stunning.
I was looking on the site yesterday. Was it yesterday? And I was trying to look for the Maryland. I'm like, I guess I don't have Maryland yet. But now you're telling me I got to double check.
Yeah, Rick, is it on the website or no? I think it is. No, maybe not. Rick, okay. In the meantime, what you got?
All right, mine's is it was a stop that turned into like a mini pursuit and ended up being like a DUI. So I was following this car for like 2 miles, like little less than 2 miles, maybe less than 2 miles, mm-hmm. maybe like a mile. And, you know, definitely signs of impairment, almost hit the Jersey barrier a couple times, went over the solid yellow line, the broken white lines.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to the red light to make a left-hand turn, I was like, all right, I'm going to light him up right here because he can pull into the gas station. He almost hits the Jersey wall. I light him up, and he just keeps going, stops, keeps going, stops, waves out the window, and then books it, mm-hmm. takes off. So I start following him. The roads were windy, so I cut the lights and sirens off. Mm-hmm. And then he pulls into his driveway. I see him pull into – I didn't know it was his driveway. Pulls into a driveway. I pull in right behind him. I order him out the vehicle. He gets out. Well, before he gets out, I hear like, you know how like glass bottles make a distinct noise?
Sure.
Like,
tick. Yep.
So I hear that. I was like, okay, like, I don't know what this dude's doing. Okay.
Yeah,
he gets out the car. He's stumbling and so forth and all that stuff. I placed him under arrest, DUI. I'm like, this guy is definitely impaired. His wife comes out. His wife's like, he's probably drunk again. And I'm like, yep, he is. And we searched the cars on his driveway. And I found out that's his residence.
Yep.
On the driveway.
Yep.
And we searched the car, incident to arrest. We obviously find 6 Corona bottles.
Mm-hmm.
And playing in a floorboard and everything. That's all we found. And then we left the car there. We're not going to tow it. We left it there for the wife. And then we took him to the jail. Good to go, or?
Chris, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're good to go there. I don't see any issues with that, given that you never lost sight of him. The fact that you've articulated what you've articulated as far as developing your probable cause for the stop, I think you've got more than enough there.
I think Emmanuel's referring to the curtilage issue, right? I think he's maybe wondering, hey, what allows us to search that car while we're on his curtilage?
Yeah, correct. That, 'cause I remember there was a case. I think you brought it up.
Yeah, Collins v. Virginia. Yeah.
No, yeah, that was another one. I think it was in California. It was a DUI. Also, well, actually, no, you did bring it up in the webinar.
Lane.
It was a noise complaint, but it was a noise complaint, and then it ended up being the guy was also DUI.
Yeah, yeah.
So when we did the search incident arrest, I'm not gonna lie, like in my head, I just went with the flow, like I was super confident, but I always question myself, like what case is gonna back me up here? I'm like, no, I think I'm good because. Yep. I followed him the whole way, had sight of him. He pulls into his residence, clearly trying to evade the police.
Yep.
And then we searched his car into interest for the DUI. And so.
Yep. What about that issue, Chris?
He was breaking up a little bit.
So, look, I mean, at the end of the day, do you think that what the cop did here violates Collins v. Virginia?
I do not. I don't think that violates the Collins v. Virginia.
Why not?
Decision.
Why?
I would have to pull that up and see.
You want to phone a friend? You want to phone me? All right. Can I let me try to talk about this. So, all right. I just want to pull up a case. I'm looking at a case real quick.
Have you got it? You pulled it up?
Well, I'm not pulling up Collins. I'm trying to pull up this Georgia case. Okay. Well, there's also this Montana case. So, okay. So first of all, I think we are good, Emmanuel, but let me tell you why. Okay. I think that when he pulled into his driveway, I would uphold that under two. Let's say, first of all, we have to always decide, is this even curtilage, right? There are definitely some judges out there that are like, nope, that is not curtilage. There's no sight screening. There's no barrier. There's no enclosure. Yeah, it's close to the house, but that's not good enough for me. And then you have people like me who is like, no, the area right next to the home. I mean, if a carport is curtilage and I can see the carport from the street, which is what happened in Collins, right? If I can see that carport, we look like we lost. Oh, there you go, Chris. If I can see that, why would the driveway, that the guy doesn't have a carport, but he has a driveway right next to the house. Why does that not get protected the same? That's my logic. I think that at the end of the day, I think that driveways right next to the house are generally curtilage, but we can debate on that. So let's just say the first thing is it is curtilage. The second thing is, how do we get on the curtilage? I'm going to tell you under two doctrines. Number one, consent. I think that when people pull into their driveway and then they know they're being pulled over, right, Emmanuel? They are in some ways agreeing, they're implicitly agreeing to have the interaction on their driveway. Would you agree with that, Chris?
Yes.
I would argue that, right? Wow. I mean, look, I mean, right, why not? Hey, how you doing, officer? Yeah, I just wanted to pull in here. The second thing is exigency, right? This is a hot pursuit case. There is also exigency. Being under the influence is usually exigency. Now, being under the influence is not automatic exigency. You have to articulate it, which I think most cops can do. Then let's talk about the car search issue. I think that the courts are going to uphold the car search because, again, you're lawfully present. The suspect has not told you to leave, right? However, if the person tells you to leave, then you don't have consent. Now you're going to need exigency. And the Georgia case is State versus Vickers, 2016, and it basically has to do with this. The cops were there for a knock and talk essentially, and they started searching a car in the driveway. The court found that it was curtilage. and that the cops did not have either permission or any agency to search the car in the driveway for evidence of a crime. And so here, as long as they brought you there initially because of the traffic stop, as long as the suspect does not tell you to beat it and to leave, I think you're there with consent. And that's what I would go with. And I think the court is going to uphold it, because otherwise they're going to make your job very, very hard. But I got to tell you, the way I'm reading the case law, if they tell you to leave and you don't have agency, which you may have, but if you don't have it, I think you are supposed to get a warrant. Emmanuel.
So even if he gets out the car and I know I'm going to arrest him and he says, get the fuck out of here, leave.
No. Are you already? Wait. Are you okay? First of all, look. Are you already on his curtilage at this point? Before he tells you to beat it, are you on his curtilage?
Yes. So in this case, he has a little bit of a long driveway. It was like two other cars, so he wasn't like immediately direct next to his house. But he literally gets out, walks towards me, and then I smell the alcohol, whatever.
Okay.
And then I lock them up and then throw them in the back of my car. Then
you shouldn't throw people, search. But okay. Yeah.
No.
But I know, Jimmy. That's what they do in Illinois, huh, Josh? So.
Oh, shit.
Was that too soon, Josh? Josh is my buddy, by the way. So I can say things like that and get away with it, even though he works out. So he could probably really beat me up pretty bad if I piss him off. So here's the deal. You're probably not even on curtilage, Emmanuel. I mean, if you're saying that you're not like right next to the house and there's like maybe a car or two or in front of that, right? You're probably not in curtilage. Curtilage ends very quickly. It has to be adjacent to the home. The other thing is that once you get, even if it is curtilage, once you're there lawfully, right, you get to grab and go. That's kind of like the plain view doctrine. If he tells you to leave, you don't have to leave without him. Since you're lawfully present and you have PC for him, you can take him. That's like the same thing of me getting into a house, investigating a domestic violence, and then the perpetrator saying, get out. I don't have to leave right then. I can take him and leave. Does that make sense? And so that's what's happening here. But finally, you have agency, right? This DUI investigation is agency. There is a strong governmental interest in making him go with you, you know, before this is, otherwise he just goes into his house and drinks more, contaminates his evidence, and you're not going to be able to convict him for DUI. So anyway, I think in this case, you are good either way, especially because he did not say leave at all. If he says leave after he's arrested and you want to search the car, I would arrest him. Then I would go back to the wife and say, hey, you've been really cooperative. Can we search the car? Because we think he's open containers in there. That's what I would do to solve that problem. Then you're back to consent. Does that help?
Absolutely.
And there's cops on here and there's, whoa, Anthony, no means no. He told you no. How are you going back to the wife and overriding his consent, his lack of consent? And the question is, California versus Fernandez says once the person has been lawfully removed, either by arrest or he leaves on his own, the remaining co-occupant can give consent. Okay. Good to go?
Roger that. Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, that's a good scenario, actually. Real good. Okay, Chris, anything before I move on to the next question?
No, I mean, just 2 points on there. You know,
please.
We don't get to run and just say, oh, well, I'm home now. I'm on home base. It does impact our ability to search, but it doesn't impact our ability to follow up and investigate, especially in hot pursuit situations. And as far as the Fernandez case, you know, the key with that case was making sure that you're not arresting or removing a subject off of the scene just so that then you can come back and get consent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't play games. We want good faith there too, in a sense. Even though it's debatable whether that Supreme Court really cares, but they probably will. I know there's a mention in that case about that. Can an officer detain people leaving a house while waiting for a search warrant? So if an officer is waiting for a search warrant to be signed and in regards to searching a residence, they're probably like sitting on the house, Chris, just, you know, surveilling it.
Yep.
And they see a person leave the residence. Can that person be detained?
Yes. Generally speaking, you can freeze the individuals at the house.
Mm. But there's no warrant, though. What's the authority? I'm not saying we can't do it, but what doctrine allows us to do this seizure when the warrant has not been issued yet?
Well, that's under a recognized exception.
Which one?
The
emergency. Summers?
Yes.
But isn't Summers a search warrant has been issued case. I mean, once we execute the search warrant, then we can seize people at the residence. I mean, if the warrant has not been executed and the guy is just leaving the house, don't we need some other recognized exception to potentially seize this guy while the warrant's being issued?
Look, I mean, if you're surveilling these individuals and you've been setting up watching them and you can articulate that they, you know, are possible cohorts into this crime that you're investigating, then you can seize them there until that you can get the warrant.
So can we at least say that you're seizing because you have likely have at least reasonable suspicion for them?
Yes.
And then once the search warrant gets executed, we just seize them under Summers?
Yes.
Okay. So
that's where the Summers case is going with that. That's why it said what it did.
Yeah, I think ultimately, I think the initial seizure is not Summers because you don't have a warrant, right?
Correct, but you have the facts that you can articulate.
Yeah, so therefore it falls under just good old-fashioned Terry stops, good old-fashioned PC arrests, right? I mean, we may have PC for the guy, especially if he's an occupant and it's a drug house, then we have PC for him. If it's a friend leaving the house, we may have reasonable suspicion that he's involved in drug issues, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I usually deal with those detention cases. And then once we get the warrant, it can morph into a Summers detention, which does not require much more than just being present during the execution of a search warrant.
Correct.
Okay. Caesar, the case is California versus Fernandez, 2015, U.S. Supreme Court. Is it California versus Fernandez or Fernandez versus California? Either way, you're going to find it. Okay, this is a case from Washington. So we have to be careful already because it's the most... Oregon's the most restrictive, but this is second up. So it says, is New York versus Class applicable with a Terry contact on private property? Officers roll through a parking lot and locate a Kia with wrong license plates. The plates are not reported stolen, but they're not correct to the car. Further investigation reveals that the VIN is covered and there is an occupant in the driver's seat. In Washington, switching plates is a civil infraction and covering a VIN is a misdemeanor. Is New York versus Class applicable in this situation, even though the officer did not conduct a traffic stop? Okay, we lost Chris. I'm sure he'll come back in a second. Okay, so the answer here is likely to be we're okay here. So first of all, I do believe that New York versus Class is applicable here. New York versus Class is a exception, is a case that says that basically when you conduct a traffic stop, you have the authority to view a VIN if it's not visible from the outside, right? From the windshield. And we don't get to do it as a matter of routine, but this should be okay. And then here, this is a lawful traffic violation, right? This is a traffic stop. I know, you know, it's a civil violation, but it's still a traffic stop. We can detain these, at least the driver, to figure out where these plates came from and so forth. Because you have a lawful traffic stop, New York versus Class is going to apply. And I also think you have agency here to welcome back, Chris. You also have agency here to look at the VIN during this traffic stop, because if the car comes back stolen, you know, I know there's no motor vehicle exception in Washington. You need agency to search for evidence. But to me, this is agency to find out whether or not that car is stolen. And you're going to need that VIN to process your traffic violation. Welcome back, Chris.
Yeah, don't know what's going on the internet.
That's okay. Class is coming out. All right, I have to go teach a class in an hour, so I have to drive there. So let's make one more question, and we'll call it a day here. I don't know about that one. Okay, this one's actually pretty good. So this is a case from Wisconsin, if that matters. But the cops stop a U-Haul for a traffic violation, okay? The passenger is not on the rental agreement, and the passenger is actually paralyzed and has never driven a car in his or her life, right? They get the driver out of the car, but let's say they're friends or something like that, right? They get the driver out of the car, out of the U-Haul, and one officer is talking to the driver behind the U-Haul, and the other officer, the partner, asks the passenger for consent to search the U-Haul, right? The cab of the U-Haul. Are we good with those facts?
So we got the driver, we got the passenger.
Yeah. So the question is, can the passenger under these facts give consent to search the U-Haul? They're not on the agreements, but they are in the vehicle. You know, they're probably on a long haul, right? Somewhere, right? Going to maybe go and live, move into a different city. So,
yeah, they can give consent to search on the U-Haul.
Search. Okay. Well, let me ask you this. What if, let me change the facts and see if I change the answer. Okay. Me and you are friends and we're in a car together. We're going to lunch.
Yep.
And the cops pull me over and they know this. They know that we're just friends. They know it's my car. They know that you're my passenger. We're just going to lunch because we just went to this amazing class at Blue to Gold. And, you know, we're going to this class. So, and the cop knows you're my friends. And he asks you, can I search this car? And you say, yes. Are you okay with that?
Probably not in that situation.
So why are, and I agree. So, and I agree with all of what you're saying, by the way, I'm not disagreeing, but why? Why is the U-Haul different than my car?
Well, because your car, you have the ownership of that car. So your rights are going to trump the rights of the passenger in that case. So that's what's going to separate the two because neither.
Oh. I think we lost Chris again. You there, Chris? All right. All right. So let me, Chris is on dial up or something like that. So let me just finish the answer. I think it's different because a U-Haul seems to imply some level of control by both occupants. Like they're in the vehicle for a long period of time. They're probably going across country. They may be living out of the damn thing. They also, it implies that they have a closer relationship than just Chris and I as friends. Are you back, Chris? No. So, hey, Chris. So, hey, you back? Okay. So what I was saying, Chris, is that I think it's different with the U-Haul is because the U-Haul situation, if we just do some common sense, implies that there actually is maybe some kind of mutual control over the U-Haul, right? Correct. You know, they're going across country maybe. It also implies that they probably live together, right? They're probably roommates. Yeah, the person's not on the agreement and they don't drive it, but you know, a U-Haul is just, it just seems more like that the person, that the passenger, you know, could look around and maybe invite a friend in there or whatever, versus just my car when we're just hanging out for lunch. It's more of a longer relationship. So it seems a little different. So I see, you know, but now we can't, you would also agree though, that the passenger cannot let the cops into something that's exclusively the driver's, right? Their bag.
Absolutely. And you know, this is one of the things that we teach officers and I harp on here is, you know, if the passenger has a bag that is clearly identified as theirs and they have control over that, just because the driver may have the superior interest in searching the vehicle or giving that consent doesn't mean that we can now get the bag from the passenger.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And look, I mean, I would, this would be an easier case if they were both like driving the U-Haul, you know, whether or not they're on the agreement, they both are like sharing the driving load and so forth. But I just think a U-Haul is different than my car, where you're just a fleeting guest Correct. Versus a long-term guest. You know, it's like me going across country with you might be different than you might have some mutual control over that car versus me just taking you to lunch.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but you know, these are totality circumstances cases and you don't have to prove actual authority in most states, except New Mexico, Washington. You have to prove apparent authority.
Yep.
Does this passenger appear to have some level of control, ownership, or access, you know, a high level of access to this space? A U-Haul, probably the answer is yes. But again, my car during lunch, answer is no. Okay, guys, I got to go. I got to teach in about an hour. So I got to get kind of, you know, put some pants on and get out of here. Chris, it was really, I appreciate you being here. Any final words to our audience before we bolt out?
Nope. Just glad to have everybody here. Keep watching every week. Look our classes up. The classes, we get much more into detail, have a lot more time to go over things. So if you enjoyed this was just the tip of the iceberg of what you're going to get in a full class.
100%. And please, if you are looking to host our training. If you want Chris, you want me, you want, you know, all of our other, I can't even, you know, Craig, we have so many friggin' amazing instructors, Rios, we have so many great instructors. If you want any of us to come to your agency and teach, and it doesn't cost you a penny. You're like, hey, I'm interested in hosting. All you got to do is send an email to training@bluetogold.com, and we'll give it to the right person who handles that, whatever you're interested in. Okay. All right. And with that, my friends, you guys stay safe.
Stay safe, everyone.